You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Despite all of the scientific research that's been devoted to understanding how the human brain functions, it remains one of the great scientific mysteries. This year, the Obama administration included a major new initiative in its 2014 budget, the Brain Activity Map Project, an attempt to do for the brain what the Human Genome Project did for our genetic system. Dr. Eric Kandel, a professor of neuroscience at Columbia University, a senior investigator at Howard Hughes Medical Institute, and a Nobel laureate, was at the White House when the proposal was officially unveiled, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
It's good to have you here.
Delighted to be here.
Sunday marked the 10th anniversary of the complete mapping of the human genome. Do you see any similarities between these two projects?
No. I think that's a wrong analogy. The human genome was a major initiative, but it differed from the brain mapping program in a number of ways. One is the endpoint was clear. One needed to identify all the nucleotide sequences in the genome, but so one knew exactly what it was aiming for, and it was primarily an engineering operation, if you will, to increase the efficiency, to decrease the cost. And it was spectacularly successful. With the human brain map, we're undertaking a much more ambitious, much more difficult task. We don't know what the endpoint is. We have a range of approaches to getting there. And this is not a task that can be undertaken and solved in a decade. This is essentially a century's mission.
But don't we already know a lot about the brain? What remains a mystery?
Almost everything. We at the beginning of a great mountain range, we've made enormous progress compared to where we were 50 years ago. But 50 years ago, we were at the very beginning. So we don't understand anything about consciousness, about free will. We don't understand in detail any of the sensory systems of the brain. We don't understand motivation very well. We know very little about schizophrenia, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder. We don't have treatments for Alzheimer's disease, although we have a pretty good understanding of it. This is an epidemic. 50% of people over 90 come down with Alzheimer's disease. So there are immense problems that face the understanding of the human brain. This is why Obama's initiative is so important and far-sighted.
But this sounds like something other than a mapping project. What you're saying is
the mapping per se is not meaningful unless an understanding of function comes with it.
Uh-huh.
The mapping is a metaphor for an attempt to understand the human brain.
Because we do have a pretty good sense of the map of the brain, don't we?
What is resident where? I don't want to minimize what we understand. We do know how certain regions connect to one another, but we don't know what the functional significance is, and there are many aspects of the map we don't understand.
How much change is happening in the brain at any given time? Aren't trillions of nerve cells all firing at once?
No, not at all. They're firing in patterns, they're firing in sequence, and the pattern is very important. Many parts of the brain are silent while other parts are active, and in any region, some cells are active and others not.
So really, part of the understanding is why certain parts fire off at any given moment and others don't.
Perfect.
People often talk about the wiring of their brains or personalities. Is that an accurate way of thinking about the mind?
Well, the wiring is certainly an important part of it. We want to know the functional wiring. What is the importance of a connection? What does it mediate? How can it be modified by learning? So we want to layer on top of the wiring the functional significance.
And you said that you have no sense of how long this project would take. Why would it take, what did you say, 100 years?
I think 100 years is a realistic estimate. Because this is the most difficult challenge science has ever confronted. This is the most complex object in the universe. You have in your skull a magical organ. And we just have a glimmering understanding of how it works.
How many researchers do you think, since we're talking about 100 years at least, we're talking about scientists all over the world, aren't we?
There is a parallel initiative in Europe. There is a modest effort in Israel. So this will ultimately become an international effort. Moreover, this is different, for example, in putting a man on the moon. The man in the moon was a major scientific effort, very bold move on President Kennedy's part, but it also had a national purpose. It gave the United States an advantage in the space race. The human brain mapping project is an international effort. If you find how aspects of the human brain work in Arkansas, it's available to the rest of the world. Scientific information of this sort is not a national product. It is shared with the world. If we cure Alzheimer's disease, everyone benefits.
And we would look for a cure in understanding how the brain functions rather than in understanding the chemistry that would lead to one person, or the genetics that would lead to one person having Alzheimer's but not the next?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. They all go together. We want to understand the genetic predisposition. We want to know why one person is more likely to get it and what are the steps whereby certain genes lead to it. You're absolutely right. That all goes together.
Well, right now what we do is we put somebody into an MRI machine and we bring up some topic and watch what part of the brain fires. How much do we understand as based on that?
Well, we have much better than before we had imaging, but the understanding is quite incomplete. Let me show you. I'll give you some problems with that. First of all, the resolution is not terrific. For most studies with imaging, a single person's data are not sufficient. You have to average the data from several different people. Okay, that's unsatisfactory. You'd like to be able to get significant resolution so you can study a single individual, because people vary from one another. Issue number one. Issue number two, just because an area is active in the brain doesn't mean it is causally involved. It may be coming along for the ride. It may be informed by some other area that is really the prime mover of the behavior you're looking at.
We could have an itchy toe at the time, or there can be some free association going
right,
on.
Right, exactly. So you need to have a way of testing causality by either interfering with the function of the region temporarily or activating it temporarily in some physiological way. So you need to see what is its role in a particular behavior that you're looking at. So these are all sophisticated sequential processes that need to be analyzed.
A New York Times article from February describes one possibility, which is to create fleets of molecule-sized machines to non-invasively act as sensors to measure and store brain activity at the cellular level. The proposal envisions using synthetic DNA as a storage mechanism for brain activity. That seems straight out of science fiction. Is it even possible?
In part it is. I think there are more realistic approaches, and one of the reasons I like the way this is going now is that Francis Collins, who's head of the NIH, has been put in charge of the project, and he's having the head of NIMH, National Institute of Mental Health, Tom Insel, and the National Institute of Neurological Diseases and Stroke, Story Landis, work with him, and they've put together a committee headed by Corey Bachman and Bill Newsom, outstanding neuroscientists, and the rest of the committee is outstanding, and they're going to study the problem for a number of months, decide which strategies are best for advancing this aspect of the mission or that aspect of the mission. Let me give you an example. One way we may want to approach it is to take a very simple animal, like a worm that has several hundred cells or a fly that has several hundred thousand cells, and try to analyze a simple brain completely. That we can do in a reasonable period of time. And we can find out what is the logic between any pattern of neuronal connections and behavior. Are there certain principles that emerge there? If we do that, that's really quite encouraging, because evolution is conservative. If evolution has found something that works, it tends to hold on to it. And then we can go to progressively more complex brains, the mouse, the monkey and human brains and begin to expand what we learn, because at each point, not only are we going to be studying the logic of neural circuitry, but we're going to be developing methodologies that allow us to ask the next level question. So we probably want to not immediately try to tackle the whole human brain, but take parts of it or systems within it, but in parallel, do this with simpler animals where we can take a larger percentage of the total brain.
The building blocks approach.
You got it. But the building blocks not only in neurons, but in terms of neural circuits. You're absolutely right.
My guest is Dr. Eric Kandel, who is professor of neuroscience at Columbia University and also is senior investigator at Howard Hughes Medical Institute, a Nobel laureate. We're talking about the projected brain activity map project. The president said that the genome project produced $140 for every dollar invested as a way of suggesting that this could also be profitable, I guess, scientifically.
Well, it would be an enormous stimulus to the economy and also an enormous saving of money. Look at the cost that we now expend on psychiatric care, on Alzheimer's care. I mean, all kinds of problems that result from disorders of the brain are extremely expensive for the individual, for the family, and for society as a whole. And I don't just mean expensive in financial terms, but in social and psychological terms, the burden is enormous.
So getting back to the building blocks idea, so we go to a fruit fly.
Yes.
And what do we try to understand in the brain of a fruit fly?
What's the logic of the visual system of the fruit fly? How does it coordinate visual clues with motion, with flying? How does one take sensory information and translate it into a complex motor pattern? These are probably principles that are very general and apply to the mouse, apply to the monkey, apply to people. In fact, there are places in the country that are doing this. My own institution, Howard Hughes Medical Institute, has a full-time facility with which I'm not directly associated called Genelia Farms, which identified the fruit fly as a target organism for trying to understand completely in terms of the nerve cells that make it up.
Now, fruit flies don't have emotions, and much
sure, they do.
They do?
You can scare them, yes. Every animal can be scared. These are essential for survival. Getting pleasure out of food and avoiding painful stimuli are intrinsic to animal survival.
So if we find out how fear in the fruit fly works, that would give us a clue into how fear in all of the animals afterward, including ourselves, works?
It would not solve the problem. It would certainly give us a strong beginning, yes.
My guest is Dr. Eric Kandel. We will continue our conversation about mapping the human brain and talk about some of the things that he discussed earlier, the whole matter of Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, schizophrenia, et cetera. PTSD, which has become a big issue in recent times, after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Dr. Eric Kandel of Columbia University and the Howard Hughes Medical Institute talking about the proposed mapping of the brain. By the way, do we have any sense of whether this is actually going to go through in a time of sequestration and talks of austerity?
You're probably in a better position to comment on that than I am. One certainly hopes so. I mean, it is extremely bold of the President of the United States to identify brain science as a major target for support. Realization that not only is this important from an intellectual point of view, an enormous challenge for an innovative country like ours to understand the human mind. But this is an enormous benefit to mankind in terms of the suffering that comes from disorders of the brain.
But he also has to convince members of Congress who don't believe in evolution that this is something that would be worthwhile.
I don't think it's difficult to convince Congress that understanding the human brain is worthwhile.
In some sense, are we trying to understand a philosophical question like, what does it mean to think or to feel?
Absolutely. I mean, philosophy is a precursor to psychology, and psychology is the other maiden of brain science. They go together. You're absolutely right.
At the event unveiling the initiative at the White House, President Obama said, "Imagine if we could reverse traumatic brain injury and PTSD for our wounded veterans coming home." With the Genome Project, there was a lot of hype surrounding what we would be able to do with a complete map of the genome. And there have been some advances, but not as much as were predicted. Do you worry that a similar thing might happen with this project?
Yes, we want to avoid hype. And I think you and I have been trying to do this throughout this program, pointing out that we're nowhere near the goal, that it's a difficult task, but wonderfully ambitious and very exciting. I would take issue with you in the human genome. I think that we're getting more and more knowledge and more benefit out of the human genome. As it becomes less expensive to do, each one of us is going to have our genome done. And that's going to allow predictions for the kinds of disorders we may be predisposed to come down with, and may allow us to take preventive steps. So I think that we're beginning to see very clear things. For example, we can distinguish between different kinds of breast cancer and colon cancer, and this has changed the therapeutics of these disorders quite dramatically. We did not immediately solve all the medical problems of mankind, of humankind, but we're beginning to make progress. And with time, the human genome is going to become more and more useful. So it's not that we've reached the end point. We're just beginning to get to the point where we take more and more advantage of it.
And I'm assuming it'll be integrated into this project because there are genetic components to Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and autism.
I don't understand why you have to interview people. You have all the answers yourself there.
Well, thank you. In fact, I was hoping to get a Nobel Prize for talk show, but they don't have a category. So how would that work? Let's take schizophrenia. So we know that there is a genetic component there. Then what would we be looking for in a project of this sort?
Genetics of schizophrenia is very complicated because it is not caused by a single gene mutation, but by a combination of genes. So we need to identify the genes and see how they contribute to the disorder. What genes contribute to the different symptom complexes? Schizophrenia has cognitive, negative, and positive symptoms, right? So the positive symptoms are acting crazy, the hallucinations and the delusions, and that is often shared with other psychotic illnesses. You have psychotic episodes in bipolar disorder as well. So there is overlap between these different disorders, and maybe that's because they share certain aspects of the syndrome together.
So we could think of it in terms of a spectrum, because
right now
we're talking about autism spectrums. And
you see, autism also has some relationship to schizophrenia. In fact, Bleuler coined the term autism for the negative symptoms of schizophrenia, the social withdrawal, the sense of isolation. And there is an overlap between some of the genes involved in autism and those involved in schizophrenia. Moreover, there's a similarity between them in a very important and interesting way. Both autism and schizophrenia partake of what is called de novo mutation. De novo mutation is a mutation in which a child in a family has the disease on a genetic basis, but neither parent has it nor any of the other siblings have it. That de novo mutation occurs because it occurs in the sperm or the egg. And we now know that in schizophrenia and autism, this occurs quite frequently, de novo mutations, and it always occurs in the sperm. And that is because the sperm turn over every couple of weeks, and every time they turn over, there's an opportunity for mutations. And the older the father is, the more likely de novo mutation occurs. And in fact, we see that with elderly fathers, there's an increased incidence of both schizophrenia and autism. So that's important to know. So people make decisions about at what age they want to have children, what age they're taking a bit of a risk.
There are also environmental factors, aren't there?
That can lead to mutations? In every genetic disorder, there's an environment. and the environment plays an important role in either bringing out the disorder or preventing it from being expressed.
You were awarded the Nobel Prize in 2000 for your work into the biology of memory.
Yes.
Do you think that this mapping initiative has potential to advance the kinds of research that you've been doing into memory?
Of course. Memory has disorders of memory. First of all, we want to understand more the molecules involved in memory storage. There are different kinds of memory, and with each kind of memory, there's a short-term memory and a long-term memory, and there's a maintenance mechanism. What are the genes involved in that? Moreover, look at the number of disorders of memory we have.
we have the ability to do this now?
We have the ability to do it, but we don't have the manpower, the resources to really drive any disease really home. So I think as technology improves, as more support comes into the field, we will be able to do this for a number of disorders. Yes.
And if you had all the money at your disposal, where would you begin?
I would like to know what are the genes involved in depression, for example, or in post-traumatic stress disorder, and see whether by knowing which genes are involved, we could select armed forces personnel that are less likely to be predisposed to post-traumatic stress disorder, and those people would be safe to send overseas, or at least safer, and the other personnel we would use for other purposes. We need people in the armed services, even those that do not go into battle.
But then we have brain trauma for people who may not even be predisposed, and then they wind up also with something equivalent to PTSD.
Well, if you bang your head, yes, you predispose yourself to other disorders.
Like epilepsy as well.
Also true. But this is all probabilistic. So we want to decrease the likelihood of a person we send overseas coming down with post-traumatic stress disorder. Genetic screens can be one of the helpful steps in doing that.
My guest is Dr. Eric Kandel of Columbia University. He was present during the White House proposal of the Brain Activity Map Project. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I read that in the 50s and 60s you were thinking of becoming a psychoanalyst. How did you wind up in neuroscience?
It's actually very interesting, and it's really influenced my teaching a great deal. I was in medical school in my senior year, and I had a six-month elective period. And I decided that even a Park Avenue psychoanalyst should know something about the brain. And I walked into a lab, Harry Grunfist's lab, and he said, "What is it that you want to study?" And I said, "I would like to know where in the brain the ego, the superego, and the id is located." And he looked at me as if I was psychotic. His eyes glazed over, and he said, "You know, I don't even know whether those concepts exist. But the way to study the brain is one cell at a time. Why don't you go and work with Dominic Perper, who was one of his associates, and learn how to do that?" And I collaborated with Dom Perper, who also became a very good friend of mine. And I just fell in love with doing experiments. It's completely different than reading a book about the brain or reading a book about biochemistry to actually do experiments by yourself and to work in a lab. And this is why I encourage young people to come into my lab over the summer, for example, because it gives them a completely new view of what science is about. And so I was dating my future wife, Denise Kandel, while I was on this elective, and I said to her, "You know, I really enjoy this stuff. I could make a living out of it, but you don't have any money and I don't have any money. We want to have a family. It's impractical." And she said, "Money is of no significance." And that influenced me a great deal as she said that, although she never repeated that subsequently.
She probably regrets she doesn't regret it because it's all turned out okay, but if your career had gone in another direction, she probably would have regretted that. So do you see the ego and the superego as having any scientific significance now?
Yes. I mean, I think that there are interesting psychological ideas that come from psychoanalysis, like the importance of unconscious processes, the fact that there is an internalization of moral values, the superego, of appropriate behavior. So I think that someday we'll get an understanding. There may not be a single site for any of these functions, but certainly they represent important psychological functions that need to explain in biological terms.
Do you still believe that there is value in talk therapy?
Or absolutely.
Should we, so we shouldn't just tackle these the underlying biology of neuroses and more serious mental illnesses to understand what creates them?
I wrote a paper many, many years ago called Psychotherapy and the Single Synapse, in which I pointed out, which is now obvious, that talk therapy is a behavioral process. Let me give you an example. Helen Mayberg found that there's a particular area in the brain called Area 25 that is hyperactive in people who are depressed. She then exposed this population of patients that she had to two kinds of therapy: antidepressants, selective serotonin uptake inhibitors, and cognitive behavior therapy. And she found that if and only if they improved in treatment, that brain abnormality was reversed. So that's a beautiful example that when you undergo psychotherapy and your behavior changes, it's like a learning process. You've altered your behavior as a result of this experience. It's got to be biological. There are going to be anatomical changes in the brain that you can detect. And that's another thing we hope to come out of this brain process: better ways of evaluating which therapy works under what circumstances.
A number of listeners have expressed concerns about the moral and ethical considerations of knowing the human brain in this way. They're concerned about things like mind control after the mapping is complete. Should that be a concern?
Absolutely. These are legitimate concerns, but every time we get a biological insight into our functioning, there's the possibility of invasion and malpractice and malusage. So we have to really, the society has to be involved in thinking about this and making sure that there are sufficient restraints, sufficient examination of what's going on to prevent that from happening.
Now, you mentioned that the European Union already has a similar initiative up and running called the Human Brain Project. It's been funded with 1 billion euros, which is like a billion and almost a billion and a half dollars. So are we coming to this game late, or is it, as you suggested earlier, that really there's globalization?
It's an international effort. We'll all benefit from one another. I am absolutely confident if the American program goes ahead, it's going to be in touch with Henry Markham, who's one of the leaders of the European program, and they will coordinate efforts to some degree.
Well, we did shut down our particle collider and are dependent
yes.
on Europeans,
yes.
although I guess that science is now shared by everyone.
Yes, yes, yes. That's the wonderful thing about science.
There have been attempts to map the brain before, thinking about pseudoscientific concepts like phrenology. Are popular ideas about what the brain does and how it functions pretty far off from how scientists now understand the brain?
Yes. There were guesses. I mean, Gall, who did phrenology, he was not studying the brain. He was studying the bumps on the skull. And he thought that these had some relationship to anatomical landmarks, which they don't.
But, sure. He saw bumps and thought that the bumps really were reflected in the brain. How much can we know from just looking at the brain? If we look at the brain of somebody who has who is schizophrenic, do we see something totally different from somebody who is more typical?
No. If you just look grossly at the brain, you would, in most circumstances, see nothing. But if you looked at somebody, for example, with Alzheimer's disease, you would pick it up. In fact, one of the reasons psychiatry was so mysterious for so many years is when people died and came to autopsy and you looked at their brain and you sectioned the brain. For neurological diseases like Parkinson's disease, Huntington's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Alzheimer's disease, which wasn't discovered until 1906, one saw specific anatomical changes, shrinkage of the brain, damage to this area, damage to that area. When one came to depression and schizophrenia, one didn't see gross anatomical changes. And these diseases were called functional. And for the longest time, one thought they didn't occur in the brain. They occurred in the spirit, in the mind, which was outside the body. It was only really in the modern biology that we realized that every mental process is a biological process. And the reason we don't see the change in schizophrenia is it's more subtle. You need to look under the microscope, and then you see, yes, there is something wrong with the prefrontal cortex. There's something wrong with certain areas in the brain, in the hippocampus, et cetera, et cetera. But that requires much more subtle examination than simply examining the total brain.
Can't head traumas affect the shape of the brain? I've heard about
sure,
athletes.
They can affect the brain directly. They could cause a lesion in the brain, causing the blood vessels to constrict and therefore to cause death of those cells, and that can spread to some degree, yes.
Well, also, don't some brains shrink? I heard about an athlete whose brain had become fairly small as a result of all of the concussions.
Yes, you're predisposed to Parkinson's disease, you're predisposed to Alzheimer's disease. Protein folding disorders are tremendously increased as a result of brain trauma. In fact, I think one of the things that's going to happen is parents are going to demand much greater protection of their kids as they get involved in competitive sports like boxing, football, et cetera, in which head trauma is a possibility.
Just one more thing. Computers are often compared to brains, and obviously there are certain things computers can't do at this time, although it's been predicted that they may very well in the future even have emotions. Is there going to be some kind of a dialogue between computer development and
Absolutely.
This mapping?
Absolutely. I think mapping the human brain, understanding it better, is going to give us new insights into how we can design computers that can recognize faces, which is an issue, for example, that computers have problem with. They may facilitate language recognition, another issue that computers have problem with. On the other hand, computational models of brain function are going to be extremely helpful to test ideas and to further our understanding of how the brain functions. So the dialogue between computational science and brain science is going to be very rich.
You had a piece in this past Sunday's New York Times about how the brain reads portraits.
You do a lot of reading.
In your case, it had to be Austrian painters because of your Austrian background?
I wrote a book called The Age of Insight about Vienna 1900 and the three major artists, Klimt, Kokoschka, and Schiele, and how we respond to that, and showing how our insights into the brain are beginning to give us some idea of how we respond to and enjoy works of art.
Dr. Kandel, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me on this program. I greatly enjoyed it.
Dr. Eric Kandel of Columbia University, also winner of the Nobel Prize in 2000. ¶¶